Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the week that saw Piers Morgan interview the Prime Minister,
I'll bet you £1,000 to a refugee charity you don't get anybody on those planes before the election. Will you take that bet?
Well, I want to get the people on the planes, right? Of course I want to get the people on the planes.
£1,000.
Right? I want to get the people on the planes.
And former Fox News pundit Tucker Carlson interviewed Vladimir Putin.
So do you see the supernatural at work as you look out across what's happening in the world now? Do you see God at work? Do you ever think to yourself, these are forces that are not human?
No, to be honest.
It seems like there's no better time to ask, what makes a good political interviewer? And what makes a good political interviewee? Ollie sat down with Rob Burley, who worked alongside the likes of Andrew Marr and Emily Maitlis as the BBC's editor of live political programmes. And today is the author of Why Is This Lying Bastard Lying to Me? The Search for Truth on Political TV. Enjoy.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one!
It's the Politics Show cast.
Rob Burley, welcome to Politics Joe.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you here.
Good to be here.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm all right. I'm a bit wet. It's raining, quite torrentially.
Soggy out there.
Yeah, they managed to seep into the trainers.
So never good.
It's all day. It's going to be slightly used, little trench foot.
Fortunately, we are in a basement, so we're safe down here.
Yeah.
Before we get into the meat of
yes.
Why is this lying bastard lying to me, how would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, of course, that's a good question. My name's Rob, are we sharing?
We can if you want. Let's not talk about the book, let's just do that.
It's taken an interesting turn. I'm a former BBC and ITV kind of editor. So I ran political programmes at the BBC, and I used to edit the Andrew Marr show. Before that, I used to run ITV political show. So I mentioned those things because those are the things I've done which relate to the book. Other than that, I live in Hove, I've got two kids, I've support Liverpool, I am passionate about the stuff that's in this because it really matters.
It's a good top line. For a viewer, someone who perhaps isn't necessarily familiar with the jargon and the roles, because, you know, for example, assistant editor at the BBC actually means something quite specific, mm-hmm. Would it be fair to describe you as sort of the person on the other end of the earpiece for the presenter? Behind the camera, you're in the gallery, sort of.
Yes, yeah, that's all right. That would be true. I mean, until you're running the whole department, there are people who are more junior who would be literally having the conversation down the earpiece. And this is happening all the time, and you don't necessarily notice it if you're watching TV, which is that people presenters who are speaking and doing interviews are being told not just timings and where to look, but also what to say next. What's your next question? And that's a good thing because it gives us an opportunity and just a little bit of an advantage against the minister, say, who does this job all day long, to kind of help, just a little advantage that maybe helps our presenter kind of have the ability to step back a bit and work out what they're actually saying. Mm. It's quite hard if you're a presenter. you know, you've got a lot of stuff going on when you're on a live program. You've got a lot of stuff in the ear. You've got, you know, lots going on that's just to do with what's the next item. Well, go to the weather, whatever it is. But if you're doing an interview, some, you know, one of the things that you can do is have someone who's saying, what did they just say? That sounds a bit weird. That's not quite what the policy is. Or even just, I would just do things sometimes like, what? Or, blimey. And they know what I mean, because it would just be like, oh, I'm sort of saying, crikey, that's a funny thing to have said, or persist, you know, continue with that particular thing or whatever it is. And you build up a kind of vocabulary with the people you work with, like Andrew Neil or Andrew Marr or Emily Maddis or whatever.
That's really interesting. Could you give me a real-world example of something that's happened in the past? Because when I've had it, talk back, that is, in the past, it's always been quite specific and quite been, well, how about this? Or how does that interact with why? Let's move things on to here. But never, what?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But that might be because, I mean, so that is one of the great themes of the book, he says, potentially, is about the long-form political interview. So what that means really is an interview. See, what the political class want to do is they want to come on telly for as short a period as possible, repeat a set of lines, and then go.
Mm.
Now, that is the enemy of scrutiny and democracy. What I believe we need to go back to is what we used to have back in the day when I was a kid. Now, sadly, in the days when I was a kid, which, as you can tell, was a long time ago, it was. Let's be honest. There were three channels for a period. You may have heard about this in the story.
In the tomes, in the texts.
Oh, remember that. And there were three channels, and then when it went to four, we were like, fucking hell. But when it was three, we had, this is the truth. If it's raining in November or February, and you're nothing better to do, the TV, you switch it on a Sunday lunchtime, and there'd be people talking about stuff, and you didn't know what the hell they meant. It was mainly there's a guy called Brian Walden who was an interviewer on ITV, and he would be talking to a politician, and I wouldn't know what they were on about because the way they spoke, the complexity of the thing was just sort of bewildering to a child. Okay, you know, I'm like 8 or 9, 10, whoever. But I just sort of think something's going on here. Some sort of conversation that matters is happening, right? Now, this in a roundabout way answers your question, which is that what that was the long form interview. It was like up to 45 to 46 minutes of interviewing. Famously, Mrs. Thatcher, right? So she's just lost her chancellor in probably the biggest crisis of her career. And she goes on telly for 46 minutes and faces Brian Walden, who was a brilliant interviewer. Can you imagine that from Rishi Sunak? Can you imagine that from Keir Starmer? I don't think they would, in a hurry, do that because, you know, that has been lost as an art. Now, the reason I mention that is that many of the things I'm talking about that I was doing was the long-form interview. So it's not a case of, you know, most of the time people are in the middle of a maelstrom of things that they're, you know, that, like I say, that the weather's going to come up. There's all these different things happening. They're on a news show that is ever-changing. But if you're sitting there with one purpose, which is to, for example, interview Boris Johnson about Brexit, then by the time you get in that room, if it's done properly, you and the presenter should be very sort of simpatico. You should be knowing exactly what you're saying. So if I say to you, hey, then you know what I mean is that you're thinking back to the conversation we had before the programme started, before the recording started, and you're knowing that I'm, you know, as a colleague, go to you, what? And you're picking up on it. You don't need me to go, the worst thing for talkback is to go, can you say the thing about the select committee, about the thing? And then they're just like, what? Cause they're trying to listen as well at the same time.
Let's stick with that particular lying bastard then. There's a chapter dedicated to this in the book. It's also, I remember at the time thinking it was a fairly classic bit of political interviewing. What's in 5C, right? Well, I'll let you explain it, but essentially, Andrew Neil is interviewing Boris Johnson about Brexit.
Yeah, let me get the boring bit out of the way, right? But you need the boring bit to understand it, which is, you may recall that people talked a lot about the GATT Treaty. Now, the reason why that is relevant is because it was essentially a set of rules for international trade that had been in place since the 40s, which would allow you, in certain circumstances, to trade in a certain way. So it's an established way between different countries. It's a bit complicated, but the point about it is, Boris Johnson had mastered, this is a rare thing, but he'd mastered he'd mastered 5B, which is the clause in this treaty which said, if there's a change of circumstance, countries can essentially continue to trade on the same basis. In other words, if there's a no-deal Brexit, do you remember that? The prospect of that, suddenly we drop out of the EU without any kind of rules and regulations about how to trade with people, we can just revert to these rules, and that's what we'll do. We'll use 5B. So essentially, what we thought about that was, okay, we know he does that, because what he'd done by this point, this was in the leadership election for the Tory party. So, of course, this happened and he was elected leader of the Tory party shortly afterwards, because that's what you'd conclude if you heard this. But in any case, what happened was he would always go into interviews and talk about 5B. He loved it because it just felt, it looked like he was, you know, the master of his brief and going against the sort of the stereotype that he's a bullshitter. Mm. But of course, we've all been in seminars, right? You know, so we all know, you know, you're hungover, you go to a seminar, and it's like, if I can just get that one thing out, then like, at least it'll look like I've read the book. Mm. And that is, of course, the mode very much that he is in. And so we thought, well, what about if we ask, he's on 5B, so well, let's take him to 5C. And so that's what we did. And the way we just invited, it was like, we were inviting him, do you want to come to 5B? Come to 5B. And he was like, oh, yeah, well, I'll go to 5B. He's happily dancing along to 5B because he knows 5B. It's just great. Then it's compounded by Andrew Neil making a small error in terms of how he referred to one of these clauses, which Johnson, in a moment of beautiful hubris, decided was the opportunity for him to say, I thought you were the details man. You can't even get it right. You know, it's all about 5B. It's 5B of the GATT treaty. You know, reading it out, like, this guy's really across his stuff. 5B, come on, keeps coming. And then Andrew said, he lets it pause, and he says, what about 5C? I prefer very much to confide in, whatever that means, or confide in 5B. Sorry, but what about what 5C says? And he just says, you know, it's all about 5B. And Andrew says, you don't know what's in 5C, do you? And he goes, no. And it was like, there you are, finally you see, some people would say that's a gotcha moment, right? I would say to that, bollocks. Mm. Because that is exactly what you should do. You look at the situation, you ask yourself this question, what is the truth? Right? What is the truth of the matter? The truth is that he's not across the detail. The truth is he has the bare minimum that he needs to do to get through the interview. And what our job is, for important reasons, not because we're just wanting to have fun or a gotcha, is to reveal that truth about this guy who is saying he should be elected leader of the party and prime minister. Mm. And perhaps if people had taken that seriously, in this case, the electorate, which was the Conservative Party membership, who don't tend to necessarily sort of take those things that seriously because they have their feelings about these people and they don't get change, then they might have averted all that happened after that, which is, you know, some of the things that went wrong for him in power. So, you know, it's a really important thing to do and it worked beautifully. It didn't change anything, but it's there and people will remember it and it's in the book and it'll be in other books and it will be remembered because it's important.
Just briefly, definition of terms, gotcha. What does...
Oh, sorry, yeah. So gotcha is like, it's I think it derived from America, which is... So the way
this, not the front page of the Sun about the Belgrano.
No, not that one. A different gotcha. The thing is, what happened is, right, so essentially TV arrives, okay, around the world. This new medium, politicians realise it's an opportunity to communicate directly to people in their millions, directly into their homes. And initially, it's a kind of fairly naive, you know, and, you know, sort of good situation, which is that, do you want to come to an interview? Yes, I do. Let's talk and let's have a dialogue and then that serves the voter. But of course, quite quickly, you end up with a situation where the politicians want to control that process because things go wrong for them. So we start then a sort of a battle, a dance between the two sides all the time, down the years, about how you do it. And one of the ways in which American politicians, and it's been sort of taken up here a bit, fight against, you know, to conduct that fight, is to discredit the notion of an interview that seeks to catch you out, as in the 5B, 5C case, as a gotcha interview, which means really, this is just about you being seen to get me. It's about you, you know, catching me out and making me look stupid. Now, some of them exist, right? So, I mean, I don't know whether you ever do it. I mean, when you interview politicians, but do you ever ask things like, how much is a pint of milk, which is a classic example, right? I think it's a stupid example. Mm. But people do it because it's like that demonstrates quickly, a gotcha, you don't even know about how people live.
Yeah.
It's actually a really cheap shot.
Okay, so how do we distinguish between that and, let's say, Diane Abbott, I think it was, no, it wasn't 2019, it must have been 2017, Ferrari, LBC, how much is this going to cost? I think it was in relation to an uptick in policing numbers or something. Came out with a figure and it boiled down to essentially, you know, you'd be paying each police officer something like £8,000 a year or something. The figures didn't stack up, right? And it went mega viral, didn't it?
Yeah.
It blew up, huge moment in the campaign. Diane Abbott got a reputation that I don't think she ever shook after that. That was essentially being, you know, not, you know, being a bit sort of away with the fairies and yada, 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 which is, I think was probably slightly unfair given what transpired later. Regardless, what is the distinction between, no, you are the Home Secretary, you should really know the cost of this thing, Shadow Home Secretary, I should say, versus, you know, how much is a pint of milk?
I think it's pretty clear. I mean, so if it's a pint of milk, it's not a here nor there whether someone knows the cost of a pint of milk. I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I think I get a litre bottle. I don't know. But the point is, it's not actually important. It's not like you're asking it to elicit something or to test something apart from some fairly cheap notion that this person is a bullshitter or is out of touch.
Disconnected from the experience of others, yeah.
Yeah. That, it's kind of just a... I mean, hopefully people just don't do it anymore. I use it as an example. It's the Uber example of doing that, right? And there may be other versions of it. Whereas the interview with Nick Ferrari, I mean, Nick Ferrari's actually brilliant. He's really good. And he was like, well, I mean, the fact that he's totting it up, it's fantastic. I mean, you can't go in... I mean, it's not acceptable to go in the room as the Shadow Home Secretary. Say, I want to be your Home Secretary with a set of figures you can't substantiate. I mean, that's just absolutely...
insane.
Yeah, you can't do that. So, I mean, I think she got all she deserved for that.
Let's talk about prep then, right? So you mentioned how just perhaps even a slight intonation change in the talkback can signal to your presenter, oh, how about this thing?
Yeah.
And, you know, you talked again about 5B versus 5C. For an interview like that, Neil versus Johnson or take your pick of lying bastards.
Yeah.
How much prep goes into that? How much, if he says X, he'll probably say Y. Mm-hmm. How much tape are you watching? Run me through that process.
Well, I mean... So, I mean, again, just to briefly mention Brian Walden again. Brian Walden, who was, again, as I say, look him up. I mean, it's worth, go on YouTube and look up Brian Walden, Margaret Thatcher. You will not have seen anything like it before in terms of the drama of the moment and the nature of the interview. It's just unlike anything we have anymore. It's a terrible thing we've lost it, but anyway. The preparation that used to go to that was extraordinary. I've seen these documents. They're amazing. So what had happened is a document that thick, you know, with an interview, and it will say, Brian, we'll look at it, and it will say, If she says answer X to question Y, go to page 16C, right? I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Okay, that's the level of preparation and detail. And what he would do, the other thing he had was he had something like a photographic memory. So he wouldn't need to have that in front of him. He might have an aide memoir, but he wouldn't have that whole thing, a big thing in front of him. But he would remember and he would go and he would go. So that was the most extreme prep. You know, that's what extreme prep would look like. Mm. So what we did, I started at LWT, London Weekend Television, which was a franchise of ITV back in the distant past. And I started there in the 90s. And it was the successor show to that show. So we had a culture. Also, Peter Mandelson used to work on this show. Other people like that used to work in that place. A culture of lots of detailed prep. We had a week to prepare for the interview. So we would, you know, there'd be detailed briefs on things written, and then it would then turn into a document which would evolve, which in the end would be taken into the room by, in this case, Jonathan Dimbleby when I worked with him. And, you know, that prep would have taken a week. And certainly the weekend would have been spent role-playing it, you know, working through everything, making sure everything's correct. And then the next morning, something might have happened overnight or in the morning on a Sunday. How do we integrate that into this plan? So... you know, it's a cliche. I mean, as I mentioned Liverpool, I think Rafa Benitez used to say, prepare to succeed. And that's what it is. That's what happened with Boris Johnson. Mm. How do you get past the bluster, the bullshit? Or how do you get past someone more honourable who's just got a very strong argument but needs to be tested? And the only way you're going to do that is by working hard. So a lot of prep.
I think it was Rory Stewart, actually, I heard talking about this, preparing for an Andrew Neil interview.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, he was saying that essentially, in theory... Andrew Neil at most has spent 3 to 6 hours, you know, dealing with the detail of what he as the minister should be living and breathing.
Right,
so
exactly.
In practice, it should actually be quite easy for him to go and sit down opposite him and have a conversation about it because in theory he knows more about the subject matter than Andrew does.
Yes.
And it's, if you just sort of compare it in sort of an arms race type of way of how much time have you spent thinking about justice or, you know...
I'm really glad you said that because that's actually what I've often made that point to people, which is that you know, as I said about talkback, any advantage we can get, I mean, this is their job.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, imagine you go and do a question about your job, an interview about your job, you'd probably be fine, wouldn't you? You wouldn't have to prep for it.
You think so.
You think. Maybe you fuck up, but you just don't know what happened.
Never rule that out.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. But so he does have an advantage. But the one thing I would say about Andrew Neil, though, is that Andrew Neil is probably as well-briefed as you are, as the minister, in the sense that one of the things about him is you don't need to give him briefs because he knows it anyway. Mm. It seems amazing. So you come in and be like, there's no point in giving him a junior researcher has written a document for Andrew Neil about this policy area. He's going to know, you know, all you're doing is like embarrassing yourself probably because he's going to know more than you know.
Yeah.
He's going to know a load of it. So he would probably be quite up to speed on almost anything he could do even before he started preparing for the interview.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe don't want to go too far into this, but I actually thought there was a very discernible difference when he left the Beeb and he went to GB News. I thought you could see, because I think he interviewed Rishi, didn't he?
He did. I don't remember anything about it.
Yeah. It was one of the I think it was like opening interview or, you know, very early days or whatever. And I remember watching it and I thought this does not, and I know he obviously already has the knowledge himself, but I didn't think, it didn't feel... I don't know what it was. Something was off in the way that if you'd watched him on the Andrew Neil show or anything like that, you know.
I'd be staggered if they had anybody to prepare him to the level of...
I think it was one producer.
Yeah, and no disrespect to that producer.
No, absolutely not. Sorry, to be clear.
I think that would be hard to do. And I think he probably would be... he can do a very good interview without any help. But I think, to be honest, that's probably about... If you remember that, I mean, I don't know if people remember this, but we're in a sort of like... It's a bit dark in here. But this is better lit. This is a basement, right, in Farringdon. Well, this is better lit than the nerve centre of GB News was. Yeah. It looked like it was extraordinary. The set was just amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And I think Andrew was just sitting there like, what have I done? I mean, look at this place. They can't light it. They can't. There's no auto cue wherever it was. So I think that must be hard. I mean, I think to be fair to him, I think he's a Rolls Royce and he's used to being in Rolls Royce conditions, and suddenly he's in this shithole doing this rubbish. And it's like, it's not. And I think that, you know, he got out within no time.
Mm.
And they, to be fair to them as well, I mean, they've got better. And I think also, I would just say about GB News, I do think that at least, you know, they're in the post-Wootton era and the post-Lawrence Fox era. You know, I think that they're not in quite the place they were because they've made those changes.
And that's interesting to me. I'd like to know what you think their game is, because I look at it, okay, as a business, right?
Mm.
They have this incredibly expensive arm. They call themselves a startup, incredibly expensive arm, which is the broadcast arm of the channel, right? You know, they have to pay to get the frequency, the bandwidth, the talent, they have the studio, etc. They do quite well on digital, but not really that many people are watching them in terms of... I don't think actually it's been proven as a business model in the UK that rolling 24-hour TV news is actually a successful thing to go into.
But that's a
different conversation. Maybe we can have it. So I think if you're a startup, you look at that and go, well, surely we kill the TV arm. We keep the studio, we keep the talent, we broadcast on digital, we put all our resources into that, away we go. But they don't do that. The reason they don't do that is because there is a prestige, particularly in Westminster, about being a broadcast media publication, right?
Yeah,
you get into the pool, you get the morning round, people want to come and talk to you. And I wonder what you think their intention is, whether it is to launch a successful business or whether instead it is actually to sort of... to shift the Overton window a little bit, to adjust the political culture and to become this possibly the battleground on which the fight for the soul of the Conservative Party will take place over the next 1, 5, 10 years.
I'm sure they're interested. I mean, I don't really know, but I'm sure they're interested in doing that, and that they think, they come at it, they must, the driving, animating sort of concept behind the whole existence of it is to change the conversation and open up a channel into the right? So that must be, they're interested in doing that, and that's to grist to their mill, because that's their audience are presumably quite interested in that. And I can't remember how the audience is doing numbers-wise. But all I say is, look, you know, they've now got people like Gloria. They've got Gloria DiPiero, who's a friend of mine, who I think is very good, and they've got Camilla Tomilly, and they've got Chris Hope. So they are becoming a bit more like a conventional...
establishment, call it, maybe.
Yeah, a bit more establishment, in that these are people who are proper journalists, whereas other people were just... you know, mouths on the end of a stick. It was just awful stuff. So I think that's changed. So I don't know. I don't really mind if it exists, and it's as long as it doesn't. I mean, it's problematic when you have some of the stuff that they've broadcast that seems to be conspiracy theory oriented and all that. But I don't know. I can't really. I wouldn't want to speak too much to what their kind of plan is.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Not another one?
It's the Politics Show cast.
Rob, who do you think the most egregious lying bastard is that you've dealt with?
Ooh. I mean, it's hard to get past Boris Johnson, to be perfectly honest.
You think?
Yeah. No, I think a level of sort of... I mean, I don't know whether... Some people believe things they say when they're not true. You know, they're not... They believe the things they're saying, even though... They know that deep down they're not true. So maybe he believed it when he was saying it. Like Tony Blair, I think, had that about him. He believed things were true when he said them, even if they weren't true. I think that's where he ended up, around Iraq. So I think Boris Johnson just used... He doesn't seem to... It's well documented. I mean, I refer to an interview I wasn't part of, but that's very salient, which is Eddie Mayer's interview with... Again, folks, look it up. I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube.
Yeah, it is.
It's pretty devastating. It's a very, very, very good interview, and it really addresses that long history of things that he'd done or said or that appeared to be untrue. And I think, you know, the interview never happened, which was, if you remember, in 2019, the BBC normally interviewed all the leaders of the parties. That's a norm, a democratic norm that sprung up over time, and it was an important thing. You know, like I say, I believe in long form interviews, so it's a really important part of the election campaign. And Boris Johnson's people pretended they would do it, but of course, they never had any intention of doing it. But the interview plan that we actually had prepared was all about trust and about truthfulness. And you know what? Just looking back, it feels like we were onto something. I don't know what you think.
I think you were.
Yeah, I think we might have been. So that was about truth.
When you say pretend. They gave you the impression that they were going to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole strategy was... I mean, so essentially, people said, and there's a lot of anger, I absorbed a lot of anger from people on Twitter, particularly at the time, about this, which was that they said, how can you have a thing where... But Jeremy Corbyn can show up and do an interview, and so can the other parties, and they don't. You surely need to have them all set before you start. It sounds good, doesn't it?
Mm.
It just doesn't work like that. It doesn't. If that was your sort of way of doing it, they would never happen because you just have to get them when you can, fit it all in, and it ultimately relies upon people, being honourable.
Good chap theory.
Good chaps. It's not looking good, is it, that theory now? they've got to be honourable and say what they're not actually just stringing you along. But what I think they wanted to do was they wanted Jeremy Corbyn to be interviewed by Andrew Neil. And it was only after that happened that they began to drop the pretense that they were going to do it.
Mm.
So there's lots in the book about that. Some people think too much detail, but I just wanted to get on the record some of the things that happened there at the BBC around it and what was said to Labour. And it's quite complicated, but it was a very unfortunate moment. It was horrible. It was a horrible thing to be in the middle of because, understandably, people were very upset and angry about it because Jeremy Corbyn's interview with Andrew Neil was disastrous.
Yeah.
And you
got picked apart.
Yeah, I mean, he was destroyed, really, in the interview. So and I don't know what would happen with Boris Johnson, but I think, you know, after 5C, as we discussed, had happened earlier, then I think he probably was reluctant to do it. And actually, at the end, in fact, let me read you, this tells you a lot, okay?
Yeah.
I wrote this at the front of the book, and sometimes when I'm talking about it, I can't say, do anything but read this out, okay?
Please.
It'll take me a couple of seconds, but the first quote here is from Brian Walden, who I've mentioned, okay? He said, "The plain fact is that Westminster's time-honoured procedures for calling our leaders to account are in some respects vastly inferior to those of television." So he's arguing for television. "When it comes to uncovering truth, there is no substitute for sustained questioning in public by a single individual armed with a clear purpose." Someone like him or Andrew Neil, right? We should be proud that we in Britain have made the political interview a more effective instrument of liberty than any of the other people of the democratic world. I mean, I don't know about you, I'm feeling a little bit,
tearing up,
a bit emotional. Brian Morden, 1990. I now bring you Mr. Dominic Cummings, former chief advisor to Boris Johnson. This is what he said in 2021. Why the fuck would we put a gaffe machine, clueless about policy and government, up to be grilled for ages? This is not a hard decision. Right? So there you have it, right? There was no question that they were never going to do it. And for them, contemptuously, they just thought, let Corbyn do it. You know, if that helps us win the election, fine. And they actually act as if they were master strategists for this piece of behaviour.
Never. Yeah, why on earth would we make the decision to put him up for an interview like that? But definitely let's make the decision to put him up to be Prime Minister of the country.
Well, yeah. I mean, Ollie, that's so true. I mean, Cummings has said.
Yeah.
He knew that he wasn't capable of doing the job, but he said he's better than Corbyn, so I had to support him and put him in a position. And the thing is, I mean, it makes you think: what if you put someone like that in a position and something like extraordinary happened, like I don't know, like a global pandemic or something?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what might happen? How you can live with that, I don't know. And in fact, if that was his position, why didn't he get behind Jeremy Hunt when he was running for the Tory leadership?
Mm. I think there was an interesting. He met with all five of them.
Did he?
Yeah, Stuart, Johnson, the Saj. Oh, here's my memory now. Hunt would definitely have been one.
Gove. He knew Gove anyway.
And he told them all the same thing. You know, get Brexit done, unite the party, defeat Jeremy Corbyn. And they all sort of went off and did their own thing with it and he ended up cancelling Johnson.
So at that point, if he knew that Johnson was an idiot in his terms or incapable or whatever it is he said, he could have said, well, look, it's Jeremy Hunt. I don't like him either for whatever reason. But at least he's not an incompetent.
Mm.
I mean, I think it's unarguable that if Jeremy Hunt had been in charge when the pandemic struck, we'd probably have dealt with it better.
You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? You said it makes you think. Should it make you angry?
Yeah, it makes me angry. The whole thing makes me angry. Lying makes me angry. The state of kind of democratic discourse makes me angry. Well, why wouldn't we be angry about it?
Because I don't necessarily know if it does make everyone angry. People sort of go, oh, well, the game's the game, you know.
I know. Well, that makes me angry. Okay, so let's have a list. I mean, that's just not good enough. It's not okay. I mean, I know why you're driven to that position, and it's like, in a way, writing a book like this. And look, it's got lots of jokes and stuff. It's supposed to be fun to read.
It's a
heavy
good read.
Thank you. It's not a heavyweight sort of sits on the shelf and never gets read type of book. But I found that when I was going out and talking about it, that, you know, yes, it's really important stuff that we. It's really important we stop accepting or don't accept that this is the way things are. I don't know if I can remotely, you just write a book. I mean, all I can do is say this. We shouldn't say it's okay, that's just the way it's all a game, because it's not a game. It affects everybody. All these things affect everybody.
Mm.
If people are, you know, waiting for the NHS, I mentioned the book, I got diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, okay? I was told when I went to a GP that when she said she didn't want to say the P word, but she sort of danced around it. She said it would be a year before I'd be seen by a neurologist. That's an invitation to the middle classes to go private.
Mm.
That's a real. So is it a game? You know, as it happened, I ended up going to A&E. I was in such a bad way. But in other words, I only use that because it's a clear example of a policy that will affect you if it happens to you or some other thing happens to you. So it matters. It matters an awful lot about what they say and that we hold them to account and we know what they believe in.
Mm.
So it's not an academic thing.
It's not just an academic exercise.
No.
Okay, a couple more things before we draw things to a close.
Yes.
You write in the book that you believe that the BBC has a centre-left liberal bias, and you say as well that you think that and you know that because it's sort of your own to a certain extent. Can you talk to me a little bit about the quest for impartiality, whether or not it's actually possible or even feasible to achieve true impartiality, and what you believe the BBC's biases to be?
Well, so what do you mean by true impartiality?
Well, I guess, and that's the problem, isn't it? First of all, it's the definition of terms. Is it possible to present a story with just total objectivity, without the subjective at all? Because at the end of the day, there's the subjectivity of the presenter, the editor, the producer, I mean, the chairman of the BBC, dare I say it as well. So is it possible to present news without a partial view attached to it?
I think the answer to that is ultimately, in a strict sense, the answer is probably no. Mm. But so what's our response to that? Do we then abandon the effort because it's just impossible to achieve it in its purest sense, or do we carry on? And what I would say is that we carry on, because the reason for that is that if something's difficult, it's probably worth carrying on trying to do it, because it's difficult for a reason. And the people that I've worked with at the BBC, so what you mentioned, my bias, or the bias I refer to, everyone, you've got bias, and everyone's got bias, right? Mm. As you actually say. And so the question is, can you set it aside or try to set it aside when you walk in the room and do the journalism? And for me, it was the reason I feel like I could was because I was less interested in my views and like promoting them in some way than I was in, I got the bug of those things we talked about, of doing these interviews that really changed things or could actually hold someone to account. And so it didn't matter to me whether it was Labour, the Tories, or anybody else who was in the chair. I just wanted us to do the very best job we could do, because that gave me a lot of professional satisfaction. Mm. And most people there are like that. The only reason I mentioned the left, I think it's just true that if you're honest, that most the balance of opinion at the BBC, probably in most media organisations, apart from GB, respect, is that you have is slightly to the left. Mm. Slightly centrist left, that's probably just true. It doesn't mean that, of course, everyone's like that. And it might be that the more senior people, it's a bit more mixed, so there have been some senior Tory people, or ex-Tories, or whatever they are. Then they become advisors again and come back again. Whatever it might be, there are people there from those different perspectives. I mean, Nick Robinson's a brilliant interviewer. He used to be a Tory when he was really, a lot younger. I don't detect him going easy on the Tories.
No.
He's a journalist, first and foremost, and that's what... So in other words, it can't be achieved in a pure sense. The effort of achieving and trying produces great work. I massively support the BBC. I think it's hugely important. I think some of the cuts have been disastrous and, have left it in a position which has had to make some very, very bad decisions, or difficult decisions. And sometimes you think they're bad solutions, but it's a pretty hard thing for them to try and figure out.
Absolutely. And I actually sort of slightly bizarrely consume a lot of sort of world service content, which I think is incredibly good. And if you ask me to say, what do you think is the closest thing to impartial news that's out there, I would say the BBC.
Yeah, absolutely. But too right.
You sort of and yet.
Well, sorry, they're not the only people. Sky. I mean, I would say this. Mm. I would do some work for Sky. I'd say the same for Sky News.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a tradition in this country, and ITV. There's a tradition, ITV, Sky, and the BBC.
ITV's doing a really good job at the moment.
Yeah, they're in a place which is, I've worked for all of them, and they all come at it like this. But the BBC is sort of the preeminent one. It's the biggest one. It's this huge organisation. It's really, again, it's like I was saying about, does it matter about physical interviews not happening, or, it's just a game, or things matter. Like the BBC dying slowly by 1,000 cuts, 1,000,000 cuts, whatever it is, it matters. It's bad for the society we live in. So it should be defended.
Mm. And yeah, you're right. It is under attack from all sorts of directions. I did it before this interview, right? I went and I just hammered BBC Bias into Google News to see what would come up. And it is from almost every angle, right? And I don't know whether it's a bit of a cop-out to say, oh, well, you're pissing everyone off. So, you're clearly doing something right. You're probably close to it.
Yeah, it's not a totally irrelevant point, but I don't think it's quite the slam dunk answer that people think it is.
Okay. Sunak then. Let's finish with Rishi. Our current Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And I guess just to draw the most recent example,
you should ask me something about Starmer as well, because we're going to be balanced, okay?
Absolutely. Right. I will do. Yeah. I will do. Okay, so Rishi Sunak then.
Yeah.
Most recent policy announcement, which jumps to mind, would most likely probably be disposable vapes, right? We're going to ban disposable vapes. How does the Prime Minister make that announcement? He doesn't do it in an interview. He doesn't do it at the dispatch box. He sits down and sort of pre-shoots something with Lad Bible, and that gets sort of put out as a 1-2-minute clip, right? So it's almost the antithesis of the long-form political interview. It's controlled environment, pre-scripted. Here's the video, let's put it out.
Yeah.
And that then also sits within a context of, take your pick on his recent conference speech is actually probably a pretty good example, right? Mm. So banning meat taxes. Spades are in the ground on HS2 until I take to the stage in Manchester and cancel the leg that's going to Manchester.
Mm. Yeah.
How do you see Rishi fitting within this pantheon of lying bastards? And as a sort of follow-up question, what should people's approach to interviewing him be?
Okay, so on the first question, so actually the hardback, the first version of the book ends with sort of quite a lot of hope, because I talked to Emily Maitlis, I talked to Andrew Marr, and this was when Rishi Sunak had just become Prime Minister, and there was a feeling then, I think, that we might sort of return to some of those norms I was talking about. So we might, because I think he was generally, he was sort of, the selling point that he had and why he wins by acclamation is essentially the mad shit's over, all that stuff that's just happened, which is, we thought he was mad, Boris, but look what happened next. Wow, I'm at least a steady, kind of reasonable person. And I think, you know, you get the impression that he's a very hard-working, conscientious person in terms of the amount of effort he puts into doing the job. But in terms of communicating, he's just flailing around and down there. There's a chapter, an updated chapter in the book about the year since, in which he just goes from one place to another trying to get something, some kind of purchase that might give him some basis for which to move forward. And it never really happens. I mean, the vaping example, the one thing that made me think of, there's a good example of something that would benefit from a long interview, because there's a fundamental question there about what you think government should do. Should it? It's like there are other things. I think there's talk of, you know, this is a good one, of banning social media for the under 16s.
Don't get me started.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah. that one makes me angry in quite a massive way.
But there's a conversation there to be had about what are the limits of government.
Yes.
It's a fundamental conversation about your belief system. And really, that's a nourishing, important thing. And if you've got a belief that you say, well, I do believe in liberty, but certain things the government has to step in and do, like the vaping, and the social media, then make your case, and that is valuable. But if you're going to go 2 minutes, of course it's not going to scratch the surface of that. But he's made a choice, or he's allowed, I don't know the truth, I don't know whether he, it shows how fast he's risen, right? He was so C-list that he was sat next to me at a dinner, right?
Poor bloke.
This was not even that long ago, yeah. Right? And he sat there drinking a Coke, and I was getting sort of slowly hammered on the free champagne at the Spectator.
Yeah,
it was good. I was enjoying it, but he was fine, and we had a chat. And he seemed normal. He didn't speak in a weird way. He didn't keep talking about stopping the boats. He talked. You know,
that's really interesting, yeah. Because I've never had the pleasure of his company, but I watch his mode of communication,
yeah.
And it always seems to be a little bit condescending, a little bit. I shouldn't have to explain my thinking to you, but I'm doing you the service of explaining to you why this thing is about to happen,
right,
to you.
Do you not?
And the only time I've seen it different, actually, was when he was in conversation with Elon Musk. And when he was interviewing Musk, his accent was completely different. He struck that more transatlantic, you know, D in party and things like that. Going back to his, you know, Silicon Valley type mode of communication.
Yeah.
But then so that made me twig and was like, oh, no, the way he speaks when he's giving a speech or being interviewed, it's actually confected. It's not. I didn't think it was the way he actually speaks. So it's not.
No, he was. You know, he certainly didn't speak like that. You know, because if he had, you'd have been like. This is the way that with almost any politician. Like, if they spoke like this in any other walk of life, you'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's like I just asked you want a cup of coffee, and you said, look, the important thing is that tea is also a hot beverage. Yeah, it's like well. Yes, it is, but what are you on? And it's like, he wasn't like that. He was like a normal person. Now, I don't know whether it's condescending or where it comes from, but I feel it comes from a place of discomfort with the process and not, and this is the thing, you know, to risen to the Prime Minister without really mastering communication is odd. But then again, it's maybe a function of the fact that most of these politicians have been media trained. And that, so the attitude to media training just teaches you to be like that,
yep.
Closed up, not expansive and authentic and speaking to people. So he's. I think that's kind of infected his way of talking. So he just can't do it. So he's quite bad at, if you talk to him and throw something at him he's not expecting, he will very clumsily, with the media training kicking in, pull it back to stopping the boats or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, he would do interviews where he would repeat the five pledges, which from memory are like blah, 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 inflation, blah, 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 stop the boats. So I think I've got it there.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, he would do that and then that would be enough. And it's not. I mean, at least be artful about it rather than rubbish at it. So it's a shame. I mean, there's an interview, there's one we do in the, I refer to the book that I did with Beth Rigby, which was, was he head boy at Winchester wherever he went? All these things, Gilded Life. You know, talented, I'm sure, whatever that stuff is they do in the city. And then, you know, marries someone very wealthy and he's prime minister, you know. It's amazing. He just had a set of elections where he'd lost. So I what is the truth? He's lost that set of elections. So let's ask him, how does it feel to lose for you? And he just went, he couldn't do it. He didn't compute. So when he's in, so that proves that if he's in that conversation, he's not in a mode of conversation. He's in a mode of just send out that thing over and over again. Yeah, and it's like, I mean, look, parking, whether you think it's desirable or not desirable for the democracy, just be better at this, please, if you're going to do the job, because, you know, it's not going to work for you.
And I guess your point about it being odd, it scans because the way he came up was odd, right? You know, parachuted into the office of Chancellor in this environment where everyone's at, not just, you know, you're not coming into contact with the public. Everyone is at home. The journalists are at home. You're being interviewed over Zoom.
It's like, true.
You know, so I think that feeds into it.
Yes.
Okay, so in the interest of balance then, let's turn to the Labour leader, Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
So you may see this differently to me, but you are the expert on lying bastards, so I will defer to your better judgment. On the one hand, you have Johnson, who for me, again, I think it was Roy Stewart who says he has 1,000 ways of lying, right? He can lie by obfuscation, he can lie by misdirection, he can lie by transitioning to Latin and you don't understand what he's saying. That's one form of lying. And then you look at Keir Starmer, and on the face of it, I would possibly say that the manner in which Keir Starmer lies is possibly more Machiavellian, more calculated, and more, as a result, sinister. So, Labour leadership, right? What's the constituency I need to win? I need to win the currently quite radically left-wing Labour membership. So what does that mean? Scrapping tuition fees, nationalising utilities, the 10 pledges, all of which have essentially been cast aside now. I believe that that's quite calculated lying. In order to win over a constituency, you have to win the Labour leadership election. The next constituency he needs to win is the country. So he shifts his message. He becomes far more of a centrist, taking the template and the lessons of previous Labour leaders who have won, the most recent being Tony Blair, who fights elections from the centre and wins doing so. And then provokes the question of, when he gets into office, will he do the things that he's saying he's going to do now?
You've thought about this, haven't you?
I've thought about it a little bit, yeah. So,
you've got a theory, haven't you?
Well,
that's fine. I think it's quite, I like it. It's interesting.
So where do you see Starmer sitting within the pantheon that also contains Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson? And is it fair for me to characterise his approach to political communications in that quite calculated and sinister way?
Okay. First of all, I just want to say one thing, which is Lying Bastards is the title of the book. Right, does not mean I think every politician is a lying bastard. That's important to, because I think super sinister. I mean, one of the things I say, we'll get to it, maybe if you want to do one more question, is about how we should approach this next election, which we could talk about if you have time. On Starmer, I agree with you on the pledges. I feel like, I think we were at LBC, when I was at LBC with Andrew Marr, we asked him the one about NHS private provision. Again, in the no private provision, which, I mean, the NHS has been using private provision for decades. And it was in there as a policy, a left-wing policy. I don't think it's a very sensible policy, particularly. But he said, he wrote it and he junked it. And the odd thing for that, so I do think it was very legit. And I think, you know, people like Owen Jones who was talking about, I thought was absolutely right to say this is a problem. I mean, it's not okay to write things, it's not okay to say them, but to write them down and put them on a poster and then not do them is problematic, to say the least. So, yeah, I think that is a difficult thing for him. I think his excuse, I think, is COVID, because that allows you to kind of junk everything beforehand. I don't really think it holds water, that. The next bit, though, I think, look, the other thing about it is what he's doing is basically the game. Go back to the game, but is the game. The Labour, the opposition game, it's the playbook, right? You're elected from the left and you then... move to the right to get governed, to get elected. Sorry, you're elected by the membership on the left, and then you eventually move further to the centre and to the right in order to get elected. So I don't think that's anything new. And I think, you know, perhaps his pragmatism on that is sensible and will get him elected. I think the problem for me is what it stores up. So if you go around saying, as they have, and people probably agree with this, which is that the NHS is on its face, not on its knees, it's on its face, but you are not in a position, you will not also promise. I mean, you imply that you will somehow renew it and fix it, but you say, because of the state of finances, we can't offer any money of any significance, then that is going to make people feel pretty cynical and upset if you're implying you're going to fix it and you can't, and then you aren't actually going to go about doing that. And people are going to feel like, well, they said they were going to sort the NHS out and we're still waiting, or whatever it is. So I think it would be better for them to say something different about that if they want to renew the public sector. I think they could have decided to go into this election from a renewing the public sector point of view, if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Look, it's their choice, and I can understand why. They're carrying a Ming vase across a shiny floor, and if they drop it, it shatters, and that's their attitude, and I can understand it. So, but I just think, if they do get elected, I think that they would be wise to alter their way of communicating so that they try and connect with people in an authentic way.
Mm.
And actually, if you do that, you store up less of a problem for yourself in the long run. Because if you maintain a sort of, everything's going to be great, isn't it? This is great sort of attitude, then people will be disappointed with you. Which in the end, what happened to Tony Blair?
Let's do it then. How should we approach the next election?
Well, I think the reason I mentioned that was that I think it's easy to be cynical, okay?
Okay.
I think we can just sit here, right? We can sit here in this basement. It's a lovely basement, and we can just
you're really keen to emphasise that.
Yeah, it is a basement, but it's a nice one. But it's better lit than GB News' original studio. But the thing about this is that cynicism is shit, right? It's really crap. It's really the worst thing we can be as voters and as media. We're both media, and even if they've invited us to do it, even if they've given us every reason to be cynical, we shouldn't go into elections being cynical about this. We should try and renew our belief that this is an important democratic moment. If they let us down, we can point it out, okay? Which they almost certainly will. But we should, I think, we as in the public and the media should give people a chance to say, to do better than they have been. And so that means that the chance we're offering is that here, actually in this basement, and also on the various outlets elsewhere, people should make themselves available to sit with you. You reach certain people who they need to reach, and it's important that they reach them. Sit here and talk to you about politics, about their beliefs, and about why their policy on housing or the health service or whatever it is a particular thing. They should love that opportunity.
Mm.
You know, you're not going to ask them the price of a pint of milk. We've established that much.
We have.
The point is, they should do it. They should come on to different things. They should do whoever the interviewer, that Nick Robinson or Michelle Hussein, whoever it is that does it for the BBC. That's what they should do. And they shouldn't just do 6-minute nonsense, sort of boring, repetitious, empty rubbish. But the public also should do some work. And one thing to bugbear of mine is the kind of question time audience thing, we don't have to do any work. We just go like, no, but I want this and I want this and I don't want to pay for it. Mm. I want the best NHS in the world and I want my taxes to be cut or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
As citizens, think about the trade-offs and make a sort of informed and thoughtful decision rather than anything else. So look, it probably won't work. I mean, nothing works, but we can try.
We can try. Rob Early, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For taking your time. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Appreciate it.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.